On the show today, spring fever shopping, making money with responsible investing, and getting creative with getting back to work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, April 15th. Good to have you with us. Couple big economic stories to start us off. The Biden administration hit Russia with a raft of sanctions today. One actually cuts off Russian government bonds from the U.S. banking system. That's a big deal. The sanctions are consequences for divisive disinformation campaigns during the 2020 election and over one of the biggest infrastructure hacks to date, the so-called SolarWinds breach from December that compromised U.S. security agencies and companies. And that one, we're still waiting to see what it might mean for our economy. Marketplace's Scott Tong has an update.
The SolarWinds hack is what's called a supply chain attack. The White House says Russian spies broke into software that tens of thousands of companies and government agencies depend on. Dmitry Alperovich at Silverado Policy Accelerator, a think tank, says the hackers' main focus is intelligence secrets, but they also compromise multiple software companies.
With the goal seeming to be to find vulnerabilities in their product, maybe even try to introduce backdoors or steal critical information. And it's clear what the Russians are doing are stockpiling as many of these supply chain vulnerabilities as possible.
These vulnerabilities threaten all of us who use, say, Microsoft programs, says Stuart Baker. He's a former National Security Agency lawyer, now at the law firm Steptoe & Johnson.
None of us is an island. We all trust the people who write the software that we are using. And if those folks fall down, we're next.
We are talking about the digital plumbing of modern life. Cyber analysts say hardware like Cisco routers was also infiltrated in the SolarWinds hack, as were parts of the power grid, says Sheethal Sethi at the University of Richmond.
We trust these algorithms and these interconnected networks to make decisions for us, but humans might not always know how to override those systems.
The hackers have burrowed in, she says, but how deeply and what the Russians' ultimate plans are remain unknown. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Now to happier topics. Spring is in the air and in our spending step. Two items on that today. Retail sales jumped 10% in March, the biggest increase we've seen since last May, and jobless claims fell to their lowest level since the pandemic started. And within that data are plenty of hints about where the economy is headed. Marketplace's Justin Ho got into that one.
First, let's look at jobless claims. Kate Bond, an economist with the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, says the numbers vary week to week. But she's been looking at the four-week moving average.
The four-week moving average helps smooth any atypical blips.
That average dropped by 50,000 claims. Bond says that's a solid sign that the economy is laying the groundwork for a recovery.
We need to make sure that that recovery is shared among all workers. But what we need is a solid foundation of job growth, and we are getting to that place.
Another sign, retail spending jumping by double digits in several categories.
Motor vehicles and parts, electronics, building and materials, sporting goods, department stores.
That's George Perks, macro strategist at Bespoke Investment Group. He says that kind of spending can ripple throughout the economy. For instance, look at food and the fact that spending at restaurants rose by more than spending at grocery stores.
That's going to have a bigger impact on employment, on tax receipts, on the commercial real estate market.
Some of that spending might be a little too hot at the moment. Wells Fargo senior economist Tim Quinlan says look at motor vehicle and parts sales, up 15% from last month.
You don't need to replace your car that regularly, so there is some risk. We could see some softening in those categories in the middle part of this year.
If that happens, Quinlan says, any weakness could be outweighed by strength in services spending as the economy opens up. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, oh, hey, what do you know? Record highs. Finally, we're on the same page. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Nearly 124 million people, almost half of the adults in the United States, have gotten at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. But the distribution is still not even. In most states, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that white residents are being vaccinated at higher rates than black residents, on average, more than 1.5 times higher. In Philadelphia, public health advocates are trying a new strategy, walk-in vaccine clinics. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today? How may we help?
Good. How are you?
You're coming for your second shot?
That's right.
In the parking lot outside Deliverance Evangelistic Church in Philadelphia, there is pretty much always a line. 5 days a week, anyone who lives in one of the city's hardest hit zip codes can just walk up and get a COVID vaccine. No appointment necessary.
Johnson & Johnson, that'll be that line over there against the wall. Let me see your ID, sir.
On a recent Wednesday, the clinic was offering two vaccines, J&J, which is now on pause, and Moderna.
Y'all coming for Moderna first shot?
Yeah.
All right.
Martin Vallier had come to church for afternoon service.
And I looked over and I saw a line. So out of curiosity, I said, let me try. Cut out a prayer service to come stand in line.
Vallier is 49 and owns a janitorial company in Philadelphia. He wasn't sure he wanted to get the vaccine, but then he got COVID.
It's horrible. I lost 26 pounds. So that's the incentive of making me, I don't want it again.
Other than his wife, who's a nurse, Vallier doesn't know anyone who's gotten the vaccine yet. And until now, he didn't know how he was going to get it. Trying to find an appointment and sign up online?
That's all too complicated for me. I'm computer illiterate. This is just simple.
This clinic is run by a nonprofit called the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium. And it's the first place Vallier has seen where he can just walk up. For the most part in Philadelphia, as in many places, you have to find appointments online. And that's how this clinic started too, says Dr. Ayla Stanford, founder of the consortium.
Initially, greater than 90% of the people that were signing up were African American.
But within a week, Stanford says, that number dropped to 50%.
And then you could just look out the window and you could see Teslas and Mercedes and Range Rovers in the area where I am, where the same people would never be caught in these neighborhoods.
That is when Stanford says she decided to scrap online registration altogether.
And we made it first come, first serve.
So everyone just stood in line. And it's working. More than 70% of the people they're vaccinating are Black. Stanford attributes a lot of that to the clinic being entirely walk-up. And a recent experiment the city did backs that up. Last month, Philadelphia reserved half of the doses at one of its vaccination sites for walk-ups, just for 6 days.
And walk-ups was kind of an eye-opener.
James Garrow is a spokesperson for the city's Department of Public Health. He says in those 6 days, the number of Black and Hispanic residents getting vaccinated increased by more than 50%. Of all the ways the city has tried to improve the racial equity in vaccine access so far, Garrow says,
none of them have produced the very crystal clear response that we saw from this.
Now, the city is starting to do walk-ups again at another of its vaccination clinics. Dr. Stanford wonders why it's taken so long.
It's just frustrating, beating your head against the wall just to get what I feel like is basic equity.
In terms of this vaccine, this has been proven to prevent hospitalizations and death from COVID.
When the Black Doctors COVID-19 Consortium first started administering vaccines, it was doing about 1,000 a week. Now, it's doing 1,000 or 2,000 a day.
Vaccines here, so now it's game time. Vaccines here. All right, so who's next?
Down the hall, it's Martin Vallier's turn, and he's nervous.
Well, where are you going to stick me?
It's over. Yeah, I'm done. See?
That's it. He's done. About 45 minutes after he first walked up and got in line.
Now I'm going to be an advocate of it. I'm going to let everybody know. Go get your shot. Tell them, come right on down here and get your shot.
That, Dr. Stanford says, is how you reach people. Go to where they are and stay there. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Speaking Speaking of the pandemic winding down, a number of big companies have announced concrete plans to start bringing workers back into offices. This is not what you might call a return to normal, because in many cases, it will not be quite the same. Companies like Ford, Target, and Microsoft are planning for a hybrid model with a blend of people on-site and remote. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Going remote overnight when the pandemic began certainly wasn't easy, but embracing a hybrid workplace might be even trickier, says Brian Kropp, chief of HR research at Gartner.
When everyone is working remote, everyone has a much more similar experience. But in a hybrid world, some people are going to be in the office 40 hours a week. Some people are going to be there 4 hours a week. That unevenness and variability is going to be really, really hard to manage.
And yet 95% of the companies Gartner surveyed are planning for hybrid work, partly because employees want it and partly because it saves on overhead. Hybrid companies will need a smaller footprint with fewer individual workspaces, says Callie Williams-Yost, a business strategist who specializes in flexible work.
There will be more spaces for collaboration. I think there will be space for uninterrupted concentrated work, but you will have to reserve them, you will have to schedule them.
And those who do show up shouldn't be given an unfair advantage, says Harvard business professor Sadal Neely.
Leaders have to develop new capabilities and competencies on how to make sure that they're running an equitable hybrid team, ensuring that they're equally helping people develop, get promoted in the organization.
That could require additional training to overcome in-person bias and careful monitoring of pay and promotions. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
cards and letters weren't coming. Magazines weren't coming.
Where could they have gone? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 305 points, 0.9% to finish at 34,035. The NASDAQ picked up 180 points, that's 0.1% and 3%, also 1.3% to end at 14,038. And the S&P 500 added 45 points, 0.1% to land at 4,170. It is an April 15th without panic for most Americans, as, of course, the IRS extended most people's tax deadline to May 17th. Not the case, though, for freelancers, gig workers, the self-employed, or if you own an S corporation. Unfortunately, your estimated tax payments are still due today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.56%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out Public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Here's another booming economic indicator. A report from PitchBook finds that in the first quarter of 2021, the venture capital industry invested $69 billion, a 93% increase over Q1 last year. Now, VC firms are known to be exclusive. It's tough to get funded without connections, and heavy on the capitalism. They believe that they'll lose money if they invest in companies with a positive social impact. They actually call it concessionary. But then there are VC firms like Kapor Capital, which aren't conceding anything. Mitch Kapor is the founding partner at Kapor Capital. Thanks for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
So let's start with the type of investing you do, which is impact investing, but focused on what you call gap filling. Can you tell me what that means?
Sure. We're investing in companies that close gaps of access or opportunity or outcome for low-income communities or communities of color.
And, you know, there's this idea, of course, in venture capital that impact investing doesn't make as much money. In 2019, you reported that, in fact, that is not the case, that almost a decade into this type of investing, you're winning on all the fronts.
Oh, that's right. We did an impact report, and our financial returns put us in the top quartile of all venture funds of our size, measured against the industry standard benchmarks. So this idea that impact investing is necessarily concessionary, you're giving up investment returns, simply is not borne out by our experience or evidence or results.
I want to ask you about some of the other things that you do differently. One is that in order to presumably attract a bigger pool of potential entrepreneurs, you have an open-ended pitch process. Like there's a form on your website that any entrepreneur can fill out. Is that manageable? And how do you evaluate the pitches that you receive?
Actually, it's very manageable. And it is liberating because it means you don't have to know us. You don't have to have a warm intro as a founder to get attention because we put everybody through a uniform process. So it's not who you know. It's, do you close gaps?
There's also a pretty common argument among the firms that I've spoken to that it's really hard to diversify their partnerships because in some cases, firms don't have that many partners. It takes years to develop someone. But Kapor Capital has four partners and two of them are people of color. Why is your strategy so different?
Well, we made a commitment to having a diverse team and funding a diverse portfolio when we started, you know, a dozen years ago. But if you rethink sort of who are in your networks, which demo days you go to, right, your network out of which you recruit, you know, is going to reflect that over time. There isn't a quick fix, but there are absolutely things that you can do.
I feel like I have been doing these interviews for a while and a lot of people say the same things. And some of the things sound just like what you're saying, except the difference is that you and your firm have actually done it. Is it just a failure of will?
I mean, if I, you know, try to lend a sympathetic ear to what I'm hearing, they are trying. But the question is, do they take it seriously or not? And part of the problem is it requires an understanding that if you're like a white male VC, you have had a set of advantages that other people have not had that have gotten you where you've gotten. And you have to hold up a mirror and say, that's not fair. And I need to do something to fix that.
What made you hold up that mirror?
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s as a kind of nerd at a time when it was very uncool. So I was an outsider's outsider and have always had that perspective. But I would give credit to my wife and partner, Frieda Kapor Klein, who has been doing this kind of work for decades, her entire adult life, for being an influence. And so over time, I was able to connect my own sense of how bad it felt to be excluded with the broader life experiences of people that have, experienced systemic racism. And I know that's a loaded word, but I think we need to get comfortable including it in our discourse.
Mitch Kapor is the founding partner of Kapor Capital. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. You're so welcome.
This interview originally aired on my other show, Marketplace Tech. Hear it and more like it wherever you like to download. Identity theft costs Americans $25 billion a year. It can demolish your personal finances. It also takes away people's sense of control. Rima Kreis is host of the Marketplace podcast, This is Uncomfortable, and she brings us one woman's 20-year journey to find her family's identity thief.
Axton Betts Hamilton remembers the first time mail started going missing in her small home in Indiana. She was 11 years old at the time.
You know, cards and letters weren't coming, magazines weren't coming, bills weren't coming.
This was the early 90s, so without the physical bills, Axton's parents had no idea how much they owed and for what. After too many missed payments, they got their electricity cut off, their landline. They found out that there was a whole other property under their name that they'd never even heard of. Somebody was stealing their information.
I really wanted to know why. You know, why would someone do this? And what have we done to this person or persons that have made them so angry that they've been doing this to us for years?
They soon discovered the thief also took out credit cards and endorsed bad checks under her parents' names. This went on for years. Her parents suspected neighbors, relatives. They filed police reports. But it all led to nothing. As her family became increasingly indebted and isolated, Axton couldn't wait to leave it all behind and go to college.
I thought the identity thief was over there. You know, the identity thief, they're over there. They can't touch me here.
Then, her sophomore year, Axton ordered her first credit report. When it arrived, she sat on her couch with her results, wondering why it was 10 pages long.
It was full of fraudulent credit card entries and associated collection agency entries that dated back to the time that my parents' identities had been stolen in 1993.
She had a credit score of 380. The identity thief had been targeting her since she was a child.
I really felt like I would never own anything. You know, I would never own a house. I would never own a car. You know, the natural milestones of being an adult.
When she tried to rent an apartment or lease a car, her low credit score was an issue. She also found out that her student credit card was canceled after trying to buy $800 worth of books. Creditors and debt collectors called to hunt down the thousands of dollars in debt the thief racked up in Axton's name. She filed a police report, but nothing came of it.
I felt like, you know, is this what life is? You know, the isolation, can't talk to anybody, always got to have, you know, eyes in the back of your head and be looking over your shoulder.
From this point on, her life took a new turn. She ended up enrolling in a grad program to study identity theft. She was determined to catch her family's thief.
It became very clear that the person most interested in resolving our case was me. So in order to do that, I had to learn as much as I could about identity theft.
One day in 2013, she was at home when she got a call from her dad. He'd found an overdue credit card statement in Axton's name.
He was furious with me, and he said, "What in the hell were you doing running a credit card over limit in 2001?
She quickly shot back.
I said, "Dad, that was one of the credit cards that was taken out in my name as part of the identity theft. Where'd you find that?" And he said, "Well, it's in here in a file folder of your mother's with your birth certificate."
Axton was confused. She had her birth certificate in her possession in 2001. Her heart started racing, her blood rushing through her ears.
I knew right then the true identity of the identity thief had been revealed. But oh my God, it was Mom.
For 20 years, the identity thief wreaking havoc on her family's life was her own mother.
When I say my blood ran cold, I felt cold.
Axon's mom had already passed away by the time she discovered the truth. She dug through all of her mom's old paperwork and found the evidence she'd been looking for years. Bank accounts under her and her dad's names, pawn shop receipts, even a mailbox she controlled that was filled with letters from the IRS.
I really wanted to know what motivated mom and that what was the point? What was the point in all this?
Axon knows she'll never get all the answers she wants. All told, she says there's at least $200,000 unaccounted just from the last couple years of her mom's life. Increasingly, children are victims of identity theft, and more often than not, the perpetrator is someone they know. In most cases, adult children don't report their parents. But Axon says if her mom were alive today, she would press charges. I'm Rima Khreis for Marketplace.
I know, my mouth is hanging open too. Incredibly, there is even more to Axon's story, and you can hear it on the This Is Uncomfortable podcast. This final note on the way out, forget Bitcoin or GameStop. The hottest asset going right now is ketchup. Increases in delivery orders and pandemic supply chain problems mean the packets, in particular, their technical name is sachets, are in such short supply that according to the Wall Street Journal, people with robust packet drawers are selling ketchup online for anywhere from $0.25 to $5 per packet. I mean, I have a little bit of a packet drawer, but it's not enough to sell on eBay. I'm sorry, but the lesson of this pandemic is hoarders always win. Look, at the time, we went a little long today, so no moment of economic context. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.